Tremendous verse, rather a famous one, I think, and very relevant for today, as I shall say in a minute. Proverbs 14:12, there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. I wanted to say that these two, secular illusion and Christian realism, are real alternatives. You've either got to have one or the other. Just as Parkinson had his law and Patrick Hutber has his, Lucas has got his law, and my law is this, that if men will not believe the Christian gospel, that is God's truth, they will believe almost anything else. By that I mean, I've said this many times, if men will not believe the truth, they will open themselves and become gullible to everything that passes by as fashionable truth today. The assumption that the humanist and the unbeliever is a brave man facing facts, free from any illusions and free from superstition and mumbo-jumbo, is just part of Satan's colossal cheek. When truth goes out, you're not left with a vacuum of free-thinking noble men. Error will come in. That is why the gospel is a bastion against false ways of thought. If you remove your stand from Christian realism, you will open yourself and your society to secular illusion. Not, of course, necessarily the old superstitions of a previous generation, but the new intellectual fads, the secular assumptions, the fashionable ideas that seem so clever in one's day but are such folly. And of that, of course, education is a very striking example. There is a way which seems right to a man, and that way can be followed with almost religious passion, as some educationalists do today, but its end, the way to death. I wanted that verse also to coincide with this great feast day in the Christian Church, January the 25th today. I never like it to pass on a Tuesday without mentioning it, the conversion of St. Paul. Surely one of the great things we ought to celebrate in the Christian Church every year. And isn't he a perfect example of the same thing? There was a way that seemed right to this man. Brainy, clever, rigorously trained, educated, passionately sure that he was right, but his end, the way of death. You see, it shows that you can feel that you have a sense of mission, that you are right and that everybody else is wrong, and yet be completely mistaken. The Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul is the great warning that sincerity is not enough, that idealism and passionate belief that we are right may not be linked with truth. One of the things about the secular thinkers of today is that they have a tremendous idealism, and often that idealism is apparently more Christian and more spiritual than the New Testament. And I want to warn you against idealism that is more Christian than Christ. It comes from not having your thinking rooted in Genesis chapter 3, the fall of man. It comes from believing that man has immense possibilities, which indeed the Christian teaches more than anybody. But forgetting that man has rebelled against God and that his world is under judgment and that therefore he has severe limitations and he can become a monster like Saul of Tarsus as well as like a saint like St. Paul. There is a way that seems right, secular illusion, but it's a way of death. I'm going to be greedy today and have a second text, if I may, to introduce my theme. That's Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. And this is a sentence that ought to be written up in gold inside every headmaster or headmistress's study in our country. Proverbs 1, 7. I don't think you'll doubt it when you read it, if you're a Christian. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Notice the converse of the fear of the Lord. If you don't fear the Lord, you're a fool. So if you are a secular thinker, though this is a very shocking thing to say, according to the scriptures, secular thinkers, in fact, are men who will lead us away from knowledge, wisdom, and true instruction. I know that's a very bold thing to say, but that's what the scriptures do say. Only the fear of God can lead us to knowledge. Those who deny God will lead us along a path that seems right, but that is a path to death. Now, I've chosen education because I think it's a good illustration of what I'm trying to say, because our Prime Minister has honestly and openly said that all is not well and has called for a national debate on it, and therefore it seems right that Christians should have their say and put forward some of the things that the Bible has to say on this subject of wisdom and knowledge and instruction. Of course, all of us know that we are not experts, especially if we work in the city where experts may be in other things. And I'm conscious, standing in this pulpit, that this is not my subject. And so I felt it right to go to another person and to find another spokesman and to take, because of the shortness of our time, just one, Mr. Brian Campbell Cook, who is the headmaster, who was, when he wrote the essay that I have in my hand, of Bedford Modern School for Boys. Before that, he was headmaster of the Queen Elizabeth Grammar School in Blackburn. So Mr. Campbell Cook has been a headmaster of two great boys' schools. And he wrote an essay comparatively recently on the Plowden Report of 1967. I don't know if he is a Christian man or not. He doesn't mention the Christian side of things in his essay, so that's all the better for my purposes. He's not grinding the particular axe that I am. But he lays his finger on this essay on three grand illusions that he found in the Plowden Report of 1967 and that he boldly and openly speaks of as a headmaster with experience. I'm going to read these three illusions out because I think they're very relevant to what the Bible has to say. First, the illusion that the distinction between work and play is largely false. In case you should think that I'm putting up straw men to knock down, that is paragraph 523 for those who are interested and want to take notes and read the report. Paragraph 523. There, the distinction between work and play, which you might think was as old as the hills, is played down as being largely false for young children and even for the whole of life. And Mr. Campbell Cook has quite a lot of fun taking some well-known sayings and inserting the word play instead of work, so that all play and no play makes Jack a dull boy, and so on. But apart from that knockabout stuff, I hope you will notice, if you're a regular on Tuesday, that this is part of the modern assault on distinctions which Christians have always held. I've said this many, many times on a Tuesday. I shall say it many times again. It is characteristic of secular thought to blur important distinctions. I mean, the most obvious one is male and female. God has clearly made a clear distinction. Unisex is unknown to the Bible. But to blur that kind of distinction brings about, of course, chaos in life and chaos in thinking. Talking about this distinction being blurred, Mr. Campbell Cook says, "The touchstone of common sense reveals the paragraph from Plowden as a dangerous piece of muddled, even dishonest argument." The touchstone of common sense. But what about the touchstone of Scripture? Well, if you know your Bible at all, and have made your way through the first three chapters of the Bible, you will know that when man rebelled against God and the curse of God fell upon him, causing life to be chaos rather than cosmos and order, that one of the first things that happened was that man's work in the garden of the world became labor and caused him much sweat and toil and anguish. And you remember that the same judgment hung over the woman whose joy in bringing a child into the world also became labor and sweat and toil. It's most interesting that the word labor is given to both in Genesis 3. So that whether we like it or not, even if we enjoy our work, and our work is something that we love to do, it is still, if we do it properly, sweat and toil. I love to prepare for you on Tuesday. But preparing for Tuesday is hard sweat. Often, as I prepare, I want to lay down my pen and give it up. Often I want to say, well, this'll do. I'll be able to get myself out of that piece of muddle thinking by just talking faster. No, to get right down to it, clear up the way you're going, to get the corners straight, to find out where the muddle thinking is, I have found in 15 years here, and I find it no less so today, tremendously hard work. Do you not find the same with all that you do and try to do well? Do not children need the same pressure to work? If this distinction continues to be blurred, a generation will grow up who do not know what work is. Through no fault of their own, and who will be utterly frustrated to discover in the real world that they can't compete, that they can't achieve any decent standards, and that they're way behind anybody else who has learned to work. All that comes from a secular illusion about the nature of work, trying to remove the curse from it, trying to pretend that everything can be play. The same distinction is blurred, of course, in Christian youth work. I want to say that I think far too much Christian youth work is playtime and not work time. You can't learn about God any more than you can learn about anything else simply by playing, simply by having an enjoyable time with music. It's part of the secular illusion. Second one that Mr. Campbell Cook puts his finger on very forcibly is, quote, that finding out has proved to be better for children than being told. Paragraph 1233. Now you say, surely that's qualified. To quote that just by itself isn't fair, you say. Well, Mr. Campbell Cook says, here is another simple swinging generalization asserted without qualification in the Plowden Report, Conclusions and Recommendations. He says it is part of an attack on authority, the bad old authoritarian school, which you may remember when you were brought up. Now, of course there have been improvements, who doubts it? Especially improvements in teacher-pupil relations. Pupils today aren't so frightened of their teachers as maybe you were of yours. And yet it is axiomatic in the Bible that I need to be taught from my earliest years. And this seems to fit in with the real world in which we live, where the mark of the child when it grows up is to say, why, incessantly. If you have Proverbs 1 open, read on, verse 8 and 9. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and reject not your mother's teaching, for they are a fair garland for your head, and pendants for your neck. By the way, you will notice there what I haven't time to go into today, that the Bible, and especially the book of Proverbs, finds a great deal of room for parental teaching in the whole educational process. And I have no doubt that the biblical mind would resist with a great deal of firmness the idea that only the educational experts in the local school have any right to educate your children. That's another secular illusion that is growing. Similarly, amongst newborn Christians, there is no way to grow except to be taught. So that the minister of the New Testament is not a priest, as I heard at a recent ordination, he is a teacher. His job is not primarily to lead worship, but to teach the truth of God. Jesus was a rabbi, a teacher. The New Testament minister is a teacher. Why is he a teacher? Because we are ignorant. And that if we are to grow from being children of God to be men of God, we must be taught. Is it possible that we will find these things out without being told them? What do children find out? Well, look at verse 10 of chapter 1. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us. Now, I won't go on reading that, because I know how irritating it is for those of you who haven't got Bibles. But if you've got a Bible, read that tonight. Because it's so realistic. Come with us, they say. Children left to find out. What will children find out if they're left to themselves? I know what I found out left to myself at the age of 13 and 14. To my sorrow and shame, I immediately got in with the wrong set of boys. I am very sorry, bitterly sorry for some of the things that I found out at that age. Left to oneself, one tends to go with the crowd because at that age you're a fool. And the Bible puts the right label on you, by nature. You need to be taught, or you will not see the danger. Verse 22, how long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing and fools hate knowledge? Why, there's something in us that hates knowledge. In any case, to find out for yourself, which is supposed to be the ideal in the Plowden Report for infant primary teaching, is in fact only allowed in universities for postgraduates, for research people. It's the hardest thing in the world to find out left to yourself. It requires a mental discipline of very great standing. As anybody who's known who's tried to do that kind of research. If this illusion grows that children and young people can be left to themselves to find out what matters, well, then the result will be that you who employ young people will find an increasingly ignorant crowd will be coming out of school to be employed, not knowing anything about the world in which they live, knowing increasingly little about all the skills necessary for the world to go round. Mr. Campbell Cook puts his finger on a third illusion in the report, which is the derision in which discipline of the older order and style is held. And I must say, Mr. Campbell Cook becomes more than sarcastic when he deals with paragraph 736. Perhaps you'll allow me just to read a part of that paragraph, in which a middle-aged visitor who was brought up in 1931, the time of the 1931 report, might discover, going into a good primary school, according to Plowden, in 1966, they would, they say rather delightfully, find much to surprise them. If he arrived at the official opening hour, he would find that many of the children had been there long before him. Not penned in the playground, the emotive language, not penned in the playground, but inside the school, caring for the livestock, getting on with interesting occupations, reading or writing, painting, carving or weaving, or playing musical instruments. Probably some of the teachers would also be early, but whether they were there or not would not affect what the children were doing. Mr. Campbell Cook says that the Plowden signatories included two HM inspectors, an ILEA inspector of schools, and were assisted by two more HMIs, so we take it that they have some knowledge and are not too starry-eyed, and yet they can write that. Mr. Campbell Cook says that he prefers to go by the research published in 1969 by Iona and Peter Opie on children, and especially boys. The headmaster says that the Plowden report seems to talk always in terms of girls. Opie says, according to the closeness of the supervision, they organize, his boys, organize gangs, carry out vendettas, place people in Coventry, gamble, bribe, blackmail, squabble, bully, and fight. The real nature of young boys has long been apparent to us. We have only to travel in a crowded school bus to be conscious of their belligerency, the extraordinary way they have of assailing each other verbally and physically, each child feeling, perhaps with reason, that it is necessary to keep his end up against the rest. Says Mr. Campbell Cook, Plowden seems to ignore boy nature, which is well known to those who actually have to teach them, and is well understood by most parents of boys. They also seem to underrate the toughness of the human species. Man would not have become the dominant species on Earth and extended his presence to the moon if he had not been extremely tough, etc. He has the right to be trained in orderly and disciplined ways of life. If a boy's right to be disciplined is not conceded in early schooling, who is bold enough to maintain that this will not have evil effects later on? Ignorant of boy's nature. Yes, that's a very telling phrase. For secular thinking is always ignorant of human nature. It always lives on a heavenly plane, because it doesn't know the Bible and doesn't know, therefore, the human heart. So we turn back to Proverbs and to a much surer ground and to those famous statements so much maligned in the 20th century, but statements which will come back again and be seen for the wisdom they are concerning the rod in Proverbs, chapter 22, verse 15. Let me simply read these out to you. These are sentences that have been in the doghouse for the past 40 years, and you hardly dare mention them in an educational conference without having to run for cover. Verse 15 of chapter 22, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. True or false? 23:13. And here surely the writer, the wise man, is writing with a twinkle in his eye. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you beat him with a rod, he will not die. And then more seriously, if you beat him with a rod, you will save his life from Sheol. Does that mean that the Proverbs is hard and tyrannical and lacks warmth? Go on to the next sentence. My son, if your heart is wise, my heart too will be glad. My soul will rejoice when your lips speak what is right. There's a lovely mixture, isn't there, of love and firmness, discipline and expectancy, Christian realism. One final verse from Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 24. And how this goes clean against the secular illusions of our own time. Secular illusion says that to punish a boy with corporal punishment, I speak now simply of what I know, that is boys at school. To punish a boy in that way is, to use the jargon of today, a violation of human personality. What claptrap that is, isn't it? Let's turn from that kind of fog to the clear air of Proverbs. Proverbs 13:24. He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. Doesn't necessarily mean the rod, of course, but it means real discipline. Thinking of that Camberwell work, which I have the honor to be a trustee of, how often the Christian workers in that work have found children who know that their parents don't love them because they don't even bother to discipline them. To find a father who would actually raise his hand, who would actually be indignant, who would actually care enough to leave the telly and rebuke him. That's all they're asking for. They don't even get that. Now you see, what this kind of thinking that produced the Plowden Report means is that as you leave behind Christian truth, you enter into a realm of folly and you believe what you're saying. My friends, education without God is a terrifying thing. I was talking to Robert Howarth about his boys at school. He was saying how Christian truth and Christian teaching is so often rejected by the authorities, but any Marxist is allowed to say what he likes. He was telling me that Toby's history teacher is a Marxist and that she really only seems to know about Chinese, Russian, and Cuban history when it comes to modern history. Do you want your children to be narrowed down just to that? Or do you want them to know about the real world? Only with the fear of God are people able to face the real world and meet it. Let me finish with another illustration, one I've used before. I remember last year turning on the radio early, listening to the education officer of Glasgow. He was being questioned fairly toughly about the young alcoholics on the street, boys of 9, 10, 11, and 12, who are already confirmed alcoholics. At the end of a quite horrendous interview, he was asked what panacea he had for these kids. Oh, he said, of course, education. If you idolize education like that, if you leave out the fear of God, if you make it impossible or do all you can to discourage fathers and mothers from doing their part of teaching, or if they don't know how to do it, then secular illusion will grip us and we're in for a horrifying future. Which are you going to choose? A life based on faith in God and therefore truth, or a life based upon fantasy and therefore error?